this undying love which shines around me like a million suns. It calls me on and on across the universe.
Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Just last month, physicists toasted the discovery of the Higgs boson, a tiny particle that helps us make sense of the forces at work in the universe every day. And starting this weekend, the Mars rover will try to uncover some different sorts of mysteries. To talk to us about both of these scientific achievements, we're joined by Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia, an author of The Elegant Universe, and he's also a frequent host of the PBS program Nova. Brian Green, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So let me actually start with the Mars rover here, because it's coming up and it's going to be a bit of a nail-biting landing. It has to slow down incredibly fast, right, to get from the outside of Mars' atmosphere to the actual landing on Mars. How does that happen?
Well, I'm not an expert on this at all, but I find it as exciting and nail-biting as anybody else. The technology they're using is novel, where the rover itself apparently is going to be lowered down from a hovering part of the ship that made the journey from Earth to Mars. It'll be lowered down on a kind of cable, and it has to be lowered down clearly in a way where the ultimate touchdown of the rover on the Mars surface is nice and soft, as this is going to be the machine that people at NASA, other scientists around the world, will be using to explore the Martian surface in a new and more precise manner.
And I think one of the really interesting things to me here is that it takes the signal from the rover 14 minutes to get from Mars to Earth. And so there may be a time where they don't know, the scientists on the ground do not know if the rover is alive, so to speak, or dead, because they're just, Mars is so darn far away.
Yeah, that's true of just about everything in the universe. Anything that's far away, it takes the light it emits or the signal that it emits a certain amount of time to travel from the origin to us. Even when we look at the sun, we're actually seeing the sun as it was 8 minutes and 20 seconds ago, because it takes light that amount of time to travel the 93 million miles from the sun to us. Similarly, Mars is over 100 million miles away from us in the current configuration. So as you say, the rover will have its fate completely sealed. It will either have landed smoothly or broken into pieces. And for 14 minutes, we won't know, because the signal will take that duration to reach us.
So let's actually listen to Adam Steltner, who's an engineer who worked on the Mars rover, and he's sort of talking about this crazy apparatus that tries to slow the rover down from going 20,000 kilometers an hour to essentially going zero, so it doesn't die when it hits the surface of Mars. Let's listen to him.
When people look at it, it looks crazy. That's a very natural thing. Sometimes when we look at it, it looks crazy. It is the result of reasoned engineering thought, but it still looks crazy.
Brian Green, are you going to be up at 1:30 a.m. on Monday seeing if the rover actually does land on Mars and doesn't slam into it?
Oh, I absolutely will, and I'm going to make my 7-year-old son and my 5-year-old daughter get up with me. I mean, I think these are the great moments of science, when the true drama of discovery is right there for you to experience it. And the same goes, I know we're going to talk about it in a moment, but for the Higgs boson, you know, when that particle was announced, it was an ordinary time in Geneva. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning, but I was out in Aspen, Colorado. So we were up 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning listening to that discovery. And to me, that is what science is all about.
So one more question about the Mars rover, which is Curiosity. Is there anything you're curious – it's called Curiosity, but is there anything that you're particularly curious about and that you hope to sort of find out from this rover, Curiosity?
Look, one of the big questions that everybody has, whether you're a scientist or not, is whether or not we are alone in the cosmos. And the best way that we can begin to answer that question is to learn – How special is it that life grew up on planet Earth? Are there examples of life in the nearby planets? And of course, the big charge of this mission is to analyze the rocky surface of Mars with sufficient precision to perhaps detect any evidence that there is or was life on Mars. And that is a big, wondrous question. And man, if we were to get a positive answer for that, how exciting would that be?
Yeah.
Enormously.
And I think they're actually putting this, landing this rover right near a big mountain and a big valley, maybe in hopes of getting those kinds of different samples, which just makes the whole thing even more nail-biting that you're trying to land a rover next to an enormous mountain.
It's a three-mile-high mountain, is my understanding.
It's amazing.
And, of course, the value of that is this outcropping of the surface has different layers that reflect the geological eras that Mars went through. So by basically slowly going up this mountain and taking samples all along the way, you get data that spans, you know, 100 million years of geological time on Mars. And within that, you may find the data necessary to give insight into whether or not there was or is life.
Right, right. So, okay, so let's talk about the Higgs particle. And I want to start actually with a little piece of sound from physicist Peter Higgs, who sort of floated the idea of this particle in the mid-60s. And he's talking in Geneva about the Higgs boson findings. Let's listen to him.
Well, I would like to add my congratulations to everybody involved in this tremendous achievement. For me, it's really an incredible thing that it's happened in my lifetime.
Brian Green from Columbia. First of all, it's sort of amazing when somebody, you know, they get older, but they're alive to see something that they posited, you know, and it's sort of come to fruition. So talk a little bit about what Peter Higgs did and why he posited it in the first place.
Well, it's important to note, because it didn't really come across in the clip, that Peter Higgs was tearing up. He was misty-eyed when this announcement was made in Geneva. It was an emotional experience for him, because back in the 1960s, he and many others were trying to solve a puzzle, which was, where do the fundamental particles that make up stuff in the world around us, where do they get their mass from, their heft? Right? We're familiar that objects have heft. When you try to throw a baseball, you feel it resisting that push, and that's its mass. When you push on a truck, it's resisting your push. That's its mass. Where does the mass of the ingredients, the particles that make up these objects, where does that come from? And the solution that he came up with was so radical that most people didn't believe it. He posited that space itself may be filled with an invisible stuff, a kind of invisible molasses-like substance that we now call the Higgs field. And his idea was that as particles like electrons and quarks, as they move through this ambient molasses environment, they feel some stickiness, if you will. And that stickiness is what gives them their resistance to having their speed changed. That is where their mass comes from. So he put forward this idea, pure mathematics, and the paper was rejected by the journal that he initially sent it to because it was just so outlandish. But in time, he gave many lectures and people started to come around to the fact that this mathematical proposal seemed to have legs.
Well, I was just going to ask, so how long did it take from the time where he said this may exist to sort of the physics community's saying, you know, you're not crazy, you might be right, and obviously now people are sort of all on board. So how long did that take?
I think it was probably in the order of years. You know, the NOVA special that you were referring to, The Fabric of the Cosmos, the last episode is actually on tonight. But the first episode had a scene where Higgs was describing what it was like to put forward this idea and have nobody believe it. In fact, he describes a scene where he was going to give a lecture at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and he's driving his car along the road, and he starts to sweat and gets so nervous that he has to pull off from the highway to try to gain some composure. And he does gain it, and he goes to the Institute and gives his talk at other places, Harvard and elsewhere. And little by little, the community begins to see, aha, this idea, however unfamiliar it is, seems to make sense. But it was definitely a significant amount of time between the initial paper and that widespread sense. And let me just add to that, when I was a graduate student in the mid-1980s, I was a graduate student at Oxford, I began to learn about these ideas, the Higgs particle, the Higgs field. For many months, I didn't know that this was a hypothetical idea. People spoke of it with such certainty by that point, by the mid-1980s, that a young graduate student who didn't know any better simply thought this was an established experimental fact, that this particle existed.
Interesting.
I then learned that it was hypothetical, and it was only in 2012 that we established that it was real.
So why did it take so long to prove its existence? We're talking really a half century that it took. Why did it take so long?
Well, it's very hard to directly access this Higgs molasses, this Higgs field. In fact, the technique that was used at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN sounds kind of brutish. The idea is you build a big tunnel 18 miles around. You have particles, protons, that you send cycling around this tunnel very near the speed of light so that they're cycling around thousands of times each second, and you smash them together. And when they smash together, the idea is that sometimes you can jiggle this Higgs environment, this molasses within which they are all embedded. And the idea is if you smash the particles together with enough energy, enough speed, you can jiggle the molasses enough that you flick off a little speck. And that little speck we call a Higgs particle. But to actually do that, you need to slam the particles together pretty hard, pretty high energy. And that takes a big machine. And it took us until, 2012 to build a machine that was big enough to jiggle the molasses enough to flick off a little speck and find that Higgs boson, that Higgs particle.
I'm talking to Brian Green, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University. And Brian, I wonder, when people who are sort of not physicists, not scientists say, why should I care about this tiny little particle? What do you say to them?
Well, I'm fond of noting that you don't have to care about it and noting that I know people that don't care about it. I mean, my mother is one such person. You know, she still says, why aren't you a doctor? You know, and I just have to convince her that what we do has value as well. And
do you say I am a doctor?
I do. I've tried that route. It doesn't seem to work too well. She means not that kind of doctor.
Okay.
But you know, I think the overarching idea is that we are these little puny creatures walking around this nondescript planet in the outskirts of a nondescript galaxy. And we've been trying to figure out why we're here and what the universe is all about, where it comes from, how it works. And the remarkable thing is, and this is truly remarkable, we have a theory on the table. It's been on the table for 40 years called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And it's able to describe the fundamental particles that make up everything tangible in the world around us. It describes the electromagnetic force, the nuclear forces, and it does a spectacular job of describing the data, the numerical data that can allow us to predict how these particles will behave. The one missing piece of this wonderful structure, the Standard Model of Particle Physics, is the Higgs particle. It's been in the theory since the 1960s, but we haven't known whether or not it's real until July 4th of 2012. And establishing this final missing piece of the puzzle, establishing that this hypothetical idea is real, completing the Standard Model of Particle Physics, is cause for celebration.
In the press, people really love to call this particle the God particle. And I know that Professor Michio Kaku, who's a professor of physics, has said that he cringes when people call it the God particle, partially because he said, in some sense, it actually might help explain how the universe got sort of started in the first place. What do you think when you hear that phrase, the God particle?
Well, I think about where the phrase comes from. Do you know the little story behind this?
That I think it was in a book, but no, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's Nobel laureate Leon Lederman, who, as you say, was writing a book about particle physics, and the Higgs particle was a key part of that. And he was reflecting on the fact that this particle is so hard to find. When he was writing the book, the particle certainly had not been found. And to capture that sense, he wanted to describe the Higgs particle as the goddamn particle. I hope I can say that on the radio. Maybe you've just bleeped it out. I don't know.
I don't think we have.
Right. So, but the publishers have said, well, that's not a good title for a book. So let's just take away the damn part and call it the God particle. So at least according to him, that's where this name comes from. And the reason why we physicists don't like it, obviously, is it suggests that there's some connection to religion. And there isn't. We're talking about brute force, straightforward physics based on a mathematical equation that we use to describe how things work. And when you start to blur the distinction between what it is that we're talking about and what it is that some others from a more theological perspective are talking about, well, it just makes us really uncomfortable.
Right, right. So I guess one question is where this leads. So this is a very exciting discovery. And one of the issues is what's next? And I read this fascinating quote from Daniel Whiteson, who's a physicist at the University of California, Irvine. And he said that discovery of a standard model Higgs is as exciting as if Columbus had actually set sail and reached India rather than bumping into a new continent. So in a way, it sort of answers the questions, but maybe it doesn't lead to other things. What's your view on that?
Well, there is a possibility that we may fall victim to our own success. So I was saying we have the standard model of particle physics. It does a great job at describing data. Our suspicion, our belief is that there's a deeper level of understanding that we haven't yet found. The question is, will we find additional clues in the upcoming experiments, the Large Hadron Collider, that gives us a sense of what that deeper understanding is? If we don't find anything else at all, just the Higgs particle, just the thing that we anticipated, then the quote that you gave is apt. We would have filled in what we thought was there. We would have closed the chapter on that particular story, but we won't know where to go next. And some people call this the nightmare scenario. I think it's an apt name, perhaps a little bit too strong, but the joy of science and the real engine, the engine of science is the things that we don't understand, the mysteries, the puzzles that we're still trying to figure out. There are many such theoretical puzzles on the table. The question is, will this big machine, the Large Hadron Collider, give us experimental clues, observational clues as to what the next step is?
And when you look at these two things together, the Higgs boson and the Mars rover, what does it tell you about the world that we live in? What sort of light is being shed on our scientific understanding of this universe?
Well, I think so many people are searching for answers to what their life means, why they're here, all those sort of deep philosophical questions. And the thing is, science, I don't think, can really answer those questions. But what it can do is it can fill out the context of those questions. It can fill out the environment within which those questions exist. It can give us some sense of how the universe got here from theories like the Big Bang and inflationary cosmology. It can give us some sense of how the fundamental workings of the universe unfold at the quantum level, and that's what the standard model and Higgs stuff is about. It can give us some insight into the breadth of the universe by giving us an understanding of the nature of other planets like the Mars rover will be doing, or through the Hubble Space Telescope taking it far further to the edges of the observable universe, the nature of the galaxies and the size of space and the processes that happened billions of years ago that gave rise to the universe that we can see. Collectively, all of these insights, I think, give us a somewhat sharper sense of how we fit into the big picture. It doesn't answer the deep philosophical questions, but I think it does ground them. And I think that's really what this stuff does to the everyday person who follows it.
Brian Green, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us this hour. Remember that you can learn more about our guests, Chris Chabry and Brian Green, at our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can also link to our free iTunes podcasts. We will be back next week with more big ideas. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
Limitless, undying love, which shines around me like a million suns. It calls me on and on across the universe.